just try and get our imaginations working again at the beginning of this study and think of Abraham and his problems. A tent. A tent? A tent! You heard me, good Jacob. Now, are you not in real estate? Abram smiled evenly. He was mischievously enjoying Jacob's confusion. Sir, of course, a tent you shall have, my biggest and best tent. Where was the patriarch building, he wondered. When was it all going to begin, and what was the tent for? Maybe it was for the workers as it built the addition onto the mansion. He busied himself selecting the list of goods his customer demanded, while Abram watched him quietly, wondering just what he was going to say. He knew the question had to come, and come it did. Excuse me asking, sir, but I trust you're not moving back to Ur of the Chaldees. We wouldn't want you to leave Haran just now, Abram sighed. Then, smiling wryly, he sought to give an answer he didn't have. Jacob, we will be leaving Haran just now, he began, but don't ask me any more. I can't tell you. We won't be going back to Ur, that I know. We'll just set off towards the Negev. Jacob's mind searched frantically for some solid ground of reasonableness. The Negev? The desert wilderness? An incredible mental picture flitted across his mind. It was of Sarah casually hanging her chandelier from the tent pole, sunning herself by a muddy desert pool and swatting flies with their palm frond, you know. He wasn't alone in his deliberations. Abram, too, had his wife in mind. What would he say when it was Sarah asking the questions? Where, Abram? She would ask, the audacity of her beauty shattering his determined course. He wouldn't answer because he didn't know. He didn't know because he hadn't heard. He hadn't heard because you never do. Here, I mean. You see, if God tells you to do something, he waits for you to obey. And he's not about to tell the next step until the first is taken. And Abraham had never taken the first. Get thee out of thy country, thy kindred, far from thy father's house. Genesis 12:1 says, God had said. How long had passed since he said it, we don't know, but it was obviously quite a long time, many years. It had not been done. Possibly it hadn't been done because the next step had not been revealed. Unto a land which I shall show thee was not enough for Abram. Maybe the man was waiting for the book to be written before he traversed page one. But that's not God's way. A command is a command not to be met with conditional obedience. If I could know the result of my action, then I would obey, we vow. But would we? Would Abram have set out, as he eventually did, not knowing whither he went, if he had known whither he went meant Pharaoh fancying Sarah, famine, war, marauding tribes, dissension in his family, and even the loss of his son? I don't think so. Possibly the step hadn't been taken because his father hadn't died. Terror possibly resembled his name, and the strong patriarchal authority in the custom of the day may have demanded from Abraham obedience and have delayed his plans. How easy it is to be sidetracked from a pathway by a member of one's family who can't understand our aspirations. I'm reminded of Jesus when the would-be disciple excused himself by saying, "Suffer me first to go and bury my father." And Jesus' strange answer, "Let the dead bury the dead, and you come and follow me." Possibly Abram was waiting for his child to be born that God had promised. We just don't know. All we know is that he did delay. Could it just possibly have been the doing of a very beautiful little prime rib called Sarah? Sarah was instructing Hagar in some duty when Abram entered his family home. "Sarah, I wish to talk with thee alone," he said quietly. "Yes, Abram," she replied simply. Heavy with emotion, hurting with apprehension, he told her it was time to leave. He watched the shadows rise in her gorgeous eyes and saw her hands pressed tightly against her cheeks as she listened with unbelief. He sought to make life in a tent in the wilderness sound the most fabulous thing they'd ever done together. All the time his eyes searched her face for her reaction. The back of his mind, an agonizing phrase repeated itself over and over again. From thy kindred, from thy kindred. Oh, omnipotence, you don't mean Sarah, do you? Abram battled on. Omnipotence had said to go, and now they must go. They'd be far from home, friends, family, and safety, but Omnipotence, who'd commanded, would also be their shield and their exceeding great reward. They'd invite Lot and his wife and the family to go too, of course, and Hagar and the servants and the livestock. He stopped. Sarah's exquisite face stopped him short. And she said, what'd she say? Isn't that frustrating? We don't know what she said. It's one of the most frustrating things. We know she went, but we don't know how she went or why she went. Did she obey her husband? Because in those days, not to obey was unthinkable. We know she packed up and left a centrally heated house, ultra-sophisticated society, an upper-class harem, to live in a tent and share her husband with her maid, lose her relatives and one of her sons at her own instigation. We know she was kidnapped by two kings, miraculously preserved, and we know she finally met Omnipotence, who touched her life and changed her character. But what was her answer? Don't you wish you knew? Well, we can read between the lines. And the way I've depicted Sarah today, I really believe, after much, much, much study and thought and prayer, is probably the way she reacted. Let's just look at Sarah's line for a moment, her lineage. After Noah had arrived on the earth and everybody else had been departed, he had three sons, Shem, Ham, Japheth, from which the whole of the earth was populated and the nations of the earth. And you can read about that just before this story. From the line of Shem came Terah, Abram's father. He had three sons, Nahor, Abram, and Haran. Haran died, leaving a little boy called Lot. And Abram, the second son, took Lot into his family and made him his heir. He made Lot, as the custom of the day demanded, heir of all things. And we'll be dealing with Lot's wife next week, so I'll leave that for that. Sarah was the daughter of his father, but not of his mother. Sarah was his half-sister. And as the custom was too, there was terrific intermarriage, especially within the high-up families, and the families went on forever. I often travel to country areas around the States, and I find that when I get there, I just find one name. I listen for it, you know, Smith. And everybody's Smith. You're quite easy. Hello, Mrs. Smith, you say, because everybody's interrelated, you know. And it's really easy to remember everybody's name because they're all called the same thing. They stay in the same place, and there's a lot of intermarriage and this sort of thing still going on. Well, in those days, so it was so. And Abram married her. She wasn't too much younger than him, about 10 years. She was a very beautiful girl. Well, Genesis 11 and 12 are an important turning point in the divine dealings. You see, before that, history was of the whole Adamic race. There was neither Jew nor Gentile. Abraham wasn't a Jew. He was just a member of the pagan society. There were no Jews. There were no synagogues. You know, we tend to think, oh, Abraham was a Jew trotting to the synagogue. No, no. He was just a member of the Chaldeans living in that part of the world. And so before this, the history in the Bible is of the whole Adamic race. But from now on, humanity has to be thought of as a vast stream from which God, in the call of Abram and the creation of the nation of Israel, has but drawn a little rivulet off, through which he may at last purify the great river itself. And so this is a very important chapter in Genesis in the Bible. Israel was called to be a witness to the unity of God in the midst of universal idolatry, to illustrate the happiness of serving him, to receive the divine instructions and pass them on and to be a human channel for the Messiah. And so that's why Sarah is so important, because you can't have a race without a woman to propagate it. And Sarah, coming at this point, must truly be one of the most important women in the whole of the Bible. Now then, Ur of the Chaldees that they lived in, let's think about her lifestyle for a minute. We've thought about her line, her lifestyle. Well, you know, people used to think it was prehistoric. Prehistoric is what it says, before history, but as soon as they dig it up, it ceases to be prehistoric. It's become historic. The only things that are prehistoric are the things that are before the history man has discovered. And up to quite recently, they hadn't discovered Ur of the Chaldees, and so they said, oh, Abraham was prehistoric, and you get a vision of a man leaping around in rawhide in the desert. But then the archaeologist Spade got busy, and now Ur of the Chaldees is not prehistoric, it is history. Archaeology, fact, scientific fact. It was the most fantastic culture that has been found. And the amazing thing was, the deeper they have gone down beyond Ur of the Chaldees, before Abraham's time, the higher the culture they have found. For example, they have found a hall of justice with the name written on it, Supreme Court. They have found tablets there with all the crimes and the punishments and the money and the accounts kept meticulously. The writing before Abraham's time was the most up-to-date thing you could imagine. They found a tomb of kings there with a gold spade in filigree gold that he used for laying foundation stones. So we haven't changed much. It was a tremendously sophisticated society. The artwork and the culture was just beyond everything. And the homes that they have dug up, they've found central heating pipes and baths within their homes, even a sort of shower in the wall. So Americans weren't the first to get that idea at all. Canals, dikes. It was just one of those societies that you wouldn't believe could exist in prehistoric times. And this is Sarah's lifestyle. Now, the common people plowed with the common little plow. They were happy in the ways of their fathers. They were pretty poor. There were two classes, the kings and their fantastic tombs and all the treasures they're digging up, and the poor people. And not just the kings, but the wealthy ruling patriarchal classes, of which Abraham was part. His family was very, very, very high up. So she was a very, very wealthy lady, was Sarah. Now remember her background. She was not a Jew. She was a member of the society of the Chaldeans who lived in that part of the area. In the tomb of one of the kings, they found 39 bodies piled up, women on top of each other, which they had suffocated, which is the way that they went about things when a king died, and one man and 39 women. They needed women's liberation, I think. But that's what had been going on. So the temple and the religion was a very important part of things. And out of all this mess, and you read for a few chapters before we get here to this point of Abraham's story, out of all this mess, there is no mention of a godly man. There is no mention of a Noah who did what was right in the eyes of God. God started all over again with Noah, and the whole thing collapsed within a very few generations. And here you get Abraham. And the wonderful thing is that Acts 7, in Stephen's defense, tells us some facts about this. Acts 7, Stephen talks about it, and he says, "The God of glory appeared unto our father Abram when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Haran." Out of all this mess, God chose him a man, and the God of glory made an appearance to one man, and it was Abram. He picked him out and he said, okay, I've got to get thee out from all this situation. You're going to be the one from whom the race is going to come and the family is going to come that I'm going to be born into. Now then, why have I given you all this background? Well, there's one other little piece of background I have to give you to tell you what Sarah was like. You've seen her lifestyle, but what was she really like? I want to tell you something about names in Genesis. There's some interesting ways that people named their children. Sometimes they named them if a war was about to break up. Ichabod's name, for example, which is a lovely name. I'm sure you'd all like to call your child Ichabod. But Ichabod meant the war is about to begin, which is very nice. You know, fancy having a child saying, come here, little war is about to begin, or whatever it was. But they named their children after events. And the thing I dug up from one of these encyclopedias, which is very interesting, they named their children late in life. Now, what they did before, I do not know. I couldn't find the answer to that. But do you know why they named them late in life? Because they waited to see their character. They waited to see their character. Now, there are many, many reasons why the countries and the Chaldeans named their children. They named them after things like coral or a beautiful tree, lovely serpent, almost like the Indian names, you know. They named them after natural and physical objects. But in Abraham's day and in that part of the country, they waited until their child was almost grown before they gave them a name. And it was usually the families and the contemporaries that named them. And do you know why this is so interesting? Well, it just absolutely fascinates me because it's got a lot to do with Sarah. Do you know what Sarah's name was? And she was named in this way. Contention. Contention. Now, that opened up a whole new field of ideas to me. Why was she named contention? What does it mean? Look in the dictionary. Do you know what it means? Strife, dispute, controversy, quarrel, especially rivalry, wrangling, constantly affecting irritation, loves an argument. Sarah. Now then, what did she say to Abraham? It's amazing how you can dig and just find out a little bit from background like that. Well, we don't know what she said. We know she went, but knowing Sarah, if that was her character, we probably know how she went. The whole thing revolved around who was her Lord. Now, we read in 1 Peter that Sarah called Abram Lord and obeyed him. But who was Sarah's Lord? It all depends who was her Lord, how she went. I believe at this point in her life, Abraham was her Lord. Not Jehovah, not omnipotence. Abraham was her Lord. I don't see any evidence anywhere in the first stories about Sarah that she knew anything about a real relationship with her Lord. Omnipotence. Abraham, yes, but not Sarah. Now then, this is why the problem arose. How you do his will depends on who is Lord. If your husband's Lord and he tells you you're going to go and live in a tent and leave this gorgeous house, you do it because he's your Lord. But how do you do it? I can imagine how she did it. But if God is your Lord and you love him as much as your husband loves him, his call is as much to you as his call to your husband. Then you're going to do that will of God in a very, very different way. Now then, I said this talk would be entitled, When to Disobey Your Husband. And really, at this point in the story, that's what we're going to talk about. Doesn't submission mean to obey always everything your human Lord says? To read a lot of women's books, you'd think it does. I would like to say it doesn't. Now, if your husband's your Lord, yes, it does. Whatever he says, you do it. But if God is your Lord, there are times when you have to disobey your husband, even if you have a husband like Abram, and not many of us have a husband like Abram. Now, I'm saying some pretty drastic things here, and I've got to get into the scriptures to show you what I mean. If you read in Genesis, let's turn to Sarah's, what I'd like to call her mistake, Genesis 12 here. Genesis 12. They got out, they were busy on their way into the Negev, into the desert, and suddenly famine hit them. And they had to do something. They had to get into Egypt to get some food. They had to survive. And Abram has a complete lapse of faith. He panics. I wonder if he'd stayed in the desert, if God would have sent the ravens to feed him or provided manna as he did in Exodus. Possibly, improbably, but he didn't. He took things into his own hands and he said, "We've got to go down into Egypt." Now God had said, "Come into a land I will show thee." And Abraham had already been shown Canaan was the land. He turned around and he went to Egypt. He panicked. God could not perform a miracle and feed them and keep them alive. And then he panicked further because he was very fond of Abram. He was obviously fond of Sarah, but at this point he was more fond of Abram than Sarah. And so the Lord had said to him, "Now you've got to go," etc., etc., chapter 13. And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had. Verse 10 of chapter 12. "There was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous. And as they were coming near Egypt, he said to Sarah," now listen, Sarah, you're a bit of all right, even though you're 60, you know, you're really gorgeous. I wonder what she was like. She must have been something with two kings to fancy her when she was 60 and 80. Can you imagine that? And so he said, "I know what's going to happen. They're going to have one look at you and tell the king about you, and then I know what's going to happen to little me. They're going to do away with old Abram to get you. So why don't we just think out a little plan? It's not really a lie. It's a half-truth. Just tell them you're my half-sister, will you?" But the import was to deceive. And Sarah, whose lord was Abraham, said, "Yes, I will obey you and I will tell a lie." And she did. And I'm absolutely convinced at that point she did the wrong thing. There's not a doubt in my mind. Abraham was telling her to do something and she should have said no. Now, she could only have said no if her relationship to God had been close and she was obeying him. And the only time we can say no as Christian wives is when the law of God contravenes the law of man. And the law of God said, "Thou shalt not lie." And Abraham told her to lie, and she obeyed him. Now, I read a marvelous Christian book, which will be nameless, which I just think is absolutely terrific, and I'm giving away to a lot of people, who said at this point, and this is the only thing I've ever read on this, that she did the right thing. And that even if your husband tells you to do something wrong, you have to do it, and God will look after you, like he did after Sarah. Stuff and nonsense. Stuff and nonsense. Counseled a woman the other day. She said, "I'm a Christian, my husband isn't. He's telling me to go to a wife-swapping party. Do I obey him?" "No, you don't obey him." That's a very obvious thing, because the law of God is contravening the law of man. But if your husband asks you to do something that isn't contravening the law of God, sure. Sure, go ahead. Love him to the Lord. Be with him. And she did the wrong thing. Now then, she did the wrong thing, incidentally, a few chapters later, having just had such a mess. Do you know the thing that gets me here? Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, was straighter in his heart than Abraham and Sarah. She brought terrific disgrace on the name of God through this, and so did Abram. They were sent away with their tail between their legs in shame, and everybody laughed at them. Laughed at Abram. Do you think that brought glory to God? And when it happened later with King Abimelech, Abimelech brought Sarah out in the front of the whole of the court, and he gave her such a terrible time. It said that she went away thoroughly red-faced. Just utter shame and degradation. She hadn't learned her lesson. She did it a second time. And so we have to ask ourselves a question. Is my relationship with God the first and most important lordship in my life? Now, when it is, he will tell you when to submit or respond, the word is, to your husband. And it will be 99% of the time. Because he is your Lord, you will be able to do it. It's the only way you can. If he is not your Lord, you won't be able to do it. But there might be a 1% time, like there was with Sarah. Abraham asked her to go to a wife-swapping party. Just old-fashioned, into the harem. And she went. She went. And so we have to say to ourselves, I have got to work on my relationship with the Lord in such a way that my husband can trust me to do the right thing. He can look at my life and see that I am obeying the scriptures, and that whenever the scriptures tell me not to do something, I've got to not to do it. What a thing it could have been if Abram had said, Abram, if Sarah had been able to sit down and say, Abram, where's your faith? We're not going down to Egypt. We're going to stay right here. We're going to get on our knees and we're going to say to God, you told us to come out. You told us you'd be our shield and our exceeding great reward. Well, shield us from famine. Provide as you promised. Abraham, come on. That's what that prime rib should have done then. And there is many, many a man of God that I've spoken to around the world that can testify to a wife when he was weak, didn't go along with his mistakes, but said, I'm here to fill up that which is lacking, and at the moment it's a lack of faith. And their faith has been the thing that has strengthened that guy at that time. I think of Gwyneth Carling. Some of you heard Dr. David Carling, who spent 12 years out in the Negev, in the desert, with lepers. One man, one doctor to a million people. And there was one point during that time when they'd lost four children out there. That was the cost of establishing what he did, which is just a miracle. It's just like Schweitzer's story. But you know, there was one point when he said to his wife, Gwyneth, that's enough. I can't take any more, we're going home. And it was Gwyneth Carling that said, David Carling, we are not going home. God called us, and he called me as much as he called you. And don't you see, the only thing that could help me to identify with these people in Chad is the fact that I've lost these children. How many children have they lost? 5 out of 6. Now they're listening to me because now I understand. And we're staying. And it was Gwyneth Carling that kept David Carling in the place that God had called him to be. It's terribly important. And this is what's so thrilling about being a woman, that you can have a relationship that's going to influence and bless your husband and challenge him. And Sarah at this point had a Lord, and it was her husband. And she did the wrong thing. Now, another thing about Sarah I see, which was a pity, was Sarah was an organizer. Her character contention that I told you just made her this way. She was bossy. She's a very proud, beautiful woman. She'd been used to bossing all the servants around all the time. And this comes out very forcibly in the story. And she had a terrible, terrible lapse. What was her lapse? We've heard about her lie. Her lifestyle, what she was like, what was her lapse. Well, turn to Genesis 16 and we'll see quite quickly. Genesis 15 is a marvelous story about Abraham and God getting together, and God has told him again and again, the baby's going to come, the baby's going to come. Well, they've been waiting for the baby to come for years, you know. The baby hadn't come. Maybe that's why he waited till the baby came. Now they'd come, the baby hadn't come. But here in Genesis 15, God meets him. He gives him a miracle. He has this sacrifice, and fire comes down from heaven, and God's presence walks around the sacrifice. The whole story is fantastic. And Abraham comes back from his time with God absolutely fired up. You can't tell me he didn't share that with Sarah. There is no question Abraham shared everything with Sarah. And I can imagine him sitting down and coming in, his face like Moses' face, coming down from the mountain. He'd met God. And sharing it with that girl. Sarah, you might think this is ridiculous. Sarah. Yes, Abraham. We're going to have a baby. A what? No, she's probably deaf by then. But it was just too much. And Sarah was very practical. This husband of hers, he was a mystic. That's what was wrong with him. If he hadn't been a mystic, they wouldn't be sitting in this tent in the middle of marauding tribes. But okay, so he needed a baby. Okay, so she'd help. Now, she understood that God could provide a baby, but obviously God needed a bit of help. So why didn't she organize God? She was so busy organizing, she organized everybody. So she set on her husband. She said, now I've got an idea, I've got a plan. She listened to all this in chapter 15, and the very first thing she said in chapter 16, verse 2, Sarah said to Abram, as if she'd never heard a thing he'd said, I pray thee, go into my maid, that I may obtain children by her. And look at this again. Just look at this. Abraham hearkened to the voice of Sarah. Isn't that something? I can't believe it. And I can't believe it when you read Genesis 15 in 5 or 6 different translations and get caught up. He's just come back from seeing God, and God said, Sarah's going to have a baby. And he walks in and Sarah says, oh, Abraham, let's be practical. You know I'm 93. I have a thing to do. Look at Hagar. This is the custom of the day. I can't have any kids, and I just accept it. And maybe this is God's plan. Let's help him out to answer his prayer. And Abraham hearkened to her voice. You need to go right back to Genesis, to the other little prime rib, and see the same thing. Adam, he didn't even say a thing. He hearkened to her voice, and he ate the fruit. And Abram did the same thing. This is the power. If only Sarah had been able to say, well, Abraham, this is ridiculous. If only she'd been able to pray. If only she'd been able to ask God for the faith, but she couldn't. She was far too bossy and organizing God. We're always doing this. We're telling God constantly how to answer his prayers. It was an impossible situation, and I appreciate it. I mean, have you ever heard of a 90-year-old woman giving birth to a baby? In the middle of a desert in a tent, you know? I mean, it was dangerous, apart from anything else. It wasn't very sterile. And here she was. But you have to turn to Romans to get the import of this. Just turn to Romans and see what God had been telling Abraham. Romans 5. Romans 4, verse 18. Abraham had overwhelming confidence that he would become the father of many nations, according to that which was spoken, so shall thy seed be. He was not weak in faith. He refused to consider his own body now dead when he was about 100 years old, neither yet the deadness of Sarah's womb. He staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but he was strong in faith, giving glory to God, and being fully persuaded that what he had promised, he was able also to perform. That, I believe, was the general attitude of Abraham. We know it was, the scriptures tell us. But it only took one stupid, little, bossy, out-of-touch prime rib to create the situation that now faces us with a world war. That's how dangerous a prime rib can be. Why are we faced with a world war? Because of the Arabs and the Jews. Boy, you tell me women haven't got power? What a mess! What a mess! And God in his grace, this is the thing that really gets to me, God in his grace picked up that poor little maid, Hagar, back in Genesis. And this is the thing about Sarah. You don't believe what I'm telling you about Sarah. Look at chapter 16. Sorry, Sarah, I know you're all different now, but we've just got to look at this. Sarah, Abram's wife, bore him no children, etc. And Sarah said to Abraham, now, come on now, let's have a baby through Hagar. Abraham listened, verse 3. Sarah, Abram's wife, took Hagar, a maid, after they'd dwelt 10 years waiting for this child in the land of Cana, they gave her to her husband Abraham to be his wife. He went into Hagar and she conceived. When she saw she conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. And Sarah said to Abram, this is beautiful. This is just great. The wrong done me be upon me. Well, whose fault was it? You know, whose idea? Whose bright idea? I have given my maid into your bosom. And when she saw she conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee.
She's quite a woman, wasn't she? And Hagar fled because Abraham, in his weakness, said, Sarah, your maid's in your hand. Do what you like to her, which he shouldn't have said. And so what did she do? Sarah dealt, and the word hardly is, incredibly harshly with that woman. She made her life hell. So much so, the woman took off into the desert to die because there was no survival in the desert. Contention. And how good God is. The angel of the Lord, a word for Christ himself, met her by the well. And he rebuked her and said, you get back there. You were wrong. You despised your mistress and submit yourself under her hand. And then he gave her a promise. He said, the son that you shall bear, I'll care for. What a mess Abraham's made, but don't worry about little Ishmael. Don't worry about him. I'm going to look after him. I'm going to make a great nation of him. I'll keep you alive. And he met her by a well. And you know, it's something to be said for Abraham that he has instilled in every one of his servants the faith of Jehovah. You read the story about when he sent his main servant to get a son for Isaac later in his story. And that man's faith was fantastic. Where did he get it from? From Abram. There's a marvelous verse in the scriptures, I think it's in Genesis 18, that says, God said about Abraham, I know you, Abraham, you're going to command your house to love me and to teach their children to do it. And here's Hagar the maid, meeting God, obeying the God, going back to Sarah. Hagar shows an awful lot more character and relationship with omnipotence at this point in the story than Sarah ever did. And later, when she's sent away to die into the wilderness with her little boy, and they're just about ready to die of thirst, and she casts the child under a shrub and sits over against him and cries her eyes out, the Bible says, God heard the voice of the lad. She'd passed her faith on to Ishmael, and he was praying, God, save us from death. And God opened her eyes and says, if you'd stop crying and open your eyes and stop blubbering, you'd see the well. We never see the well because we're crying too much. And God and Hagar had something going, you see. Sarah and omnipotence didn't. She was just contention. She dealt harshly with her maid. She constantly manipulated to help God out. Sarah's lie, Sarah's life, what was she like? Sarah's lapse into unbelief, and Sarah's laughter, Genesis 18. Here we get a lovely picture of this gal. Here's the Lord appearing to Abraham again, sitting down, coming in to sup with him, and he with us, have some time with him. And when Abraham recognized the Lord in man form, who'd come to talk with him, he rushed into the tent and he said, Sarah, we got some heavenly visitors. You better go and kill that fatted calf and we'll do what we ought to do to make them welcome. Sarah got busy and she made some patties of, hamburgers out of the fatted calf or whatever. And they began to talk. Now, it was very interesting because verse 9 says, where is Sarah thy wife? And he said, behold, in the tent. And he said, I'll certainly return to thee according to the time of life, and lo, Sarah your wife shall have a son. And Sarah heard it in the tent door. She was listening at the tent flap. That's what it means. She had her ear so elongated through that tent flap, it just looked rather strange. She couldn't wait. She was nosy. She wanted to know. Well, that's understandable. But what happened when she heard? What was God saying to Abraham? It was to do with her. She had a name. No wonder she got her ear at the tent flap. Therefore, Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I've become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? And the Lord said to Abram, why did Sarah laugh? Is anything too hard for the Lord? Then Sarah lived up to her name. She began arguing with God. Contention. Quarreling. And he didn't laugh, for she was afraid. And he said, nay. But thou didst laugh. I didn't laugh. I didn't. You know, there she is. Not only poor Abraham, now she's doing it with God Almighty. The laugh of unbelief. And then fear and lying to save her own skin. Sarah wasn't very nice. I think the worst of Sarah comes out in her dealing with Hagar. When she saw Hagar's little boy giving her little boy a hard time, she sent that woman and that little boy to their certain death. And she never knew they survived either, in all probability. She lived with that for the rest of her life. How'd you like to live with that on your conscience? Well, is that all we've got to say about Sarah? No. Praise God it isn't, or we wouldn't be wasting our time here. Because God is in the name-changing business. He did it all the time. Jacob, you twister, he said, I'm going to make you into prince with God. And he wrestled with him until he turned that man's character into something beautiful. Only God can change character. Only God can change us from the outside, from contention into princess. Sarai, he said, your name shall be Sarah, which means princess. And at some point, and we don't know where it happened or when it happened, I'm sure through all the varied and terrific times they had in that tense situation, we come to 1 Peter chapter 3, 1 Peter chapter 3, which tells us a little bit about Sarah after God had changed her name. And you just can't believe you're reading about the same woman. Peter chapter 3. Peter's talking about wives being responding to their husbands, being in subjection to their own husbands, etc. They've got to look at your life. Your life's got to win them to Christ, he's saying. It's got to be coupled with the fear of God. And you've got to dress, not with the outward adorning of braiding the hair and of wearing of gold and of putting on of apparel, but in the hidden man of the heart, even with the ornaments of a meek and a quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. And then he uses who as an example? Sarah. Sarah, not Sarai. He says, in like manner, the holy woman of old who trusted in God adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands, even as Sarah obeyed Abram, calling him Lord, and are not afraid with any terror. I do believe Sarah was an extremely brave woman. You can't have a character like that and do what she did and go where she did without admiring her audacity of bravery. And it uses this, talking about Sarah here, you've got to be like Sarah, you've not got to be afraid with any terror. She wasn't frightened of much. She wasn't frightened to argue with the Almighty. But you know what God did to her? He said, I want you to be like Sarah, who has a humble and quiet spirit. Now, only omnipotence can do that. And he did it for Sarah. I wonder where she began to have as her Lord omnipotence. We know she did. We know that Abraham buried her with great mourning and love. And she became the wife she should have been all along to him. It says in the Bible that Sarah's spirit was in the sight of God of great price. Are you like contention? What would happen if other people named you? I think of my kids. If I'd waited till now to name them, I would have named one now. And I would have named another later. And I would have named another Mercury, you know. But what would they have named me? What would they have named me? Contention? Or something else? What's your name? Well, only omnipotence can change you when you submit to his lordship, and he will then tell you who he wishes you to submit to. And all you have to do is be willing to do what he says. And 99% out of the time it will be to submit to your husband. But to have such a fantastic, growing relationship that keeps you as a person and develops your gifts and personality so that you can be the biggest challenge to that man he's ever dreamt of you being. He can respect you. Look to your judgment. God doesn't want you to disappear under a doormat type of situation. He wants to make you princess. His princess, the word means. His princess.